Okay, well, I think we'll probably kick off straight away. So welcome to this LSE Ideas event, NATO at 70, History, Politics and Challenges, which is in many ways an event designed to draw your attention to and speak a bit about the newly launched book, NATO at 70, A Historiographical Approach. And we're going to hear quite a lot more about that book tonight. Sadly, though, we're actually not going to hear as much as we hoped we were going to, simply because the book's author, Linda Risso, or the book's editor, who was going to be one of the speakers tonight, was taken ill this morning and so won't be able to join us. So we will have to manage without Linda, although some of the other speakers have kindly agreed to speak as much as they can about the parts of the book they didn't write, so as to substitute for her. And of course, the book will be available for order, I believe, at the end of the event. So those of you wanting to find out more can order a copy. Yes, there seem to be forms on your chairs. Okay, so a few housekeeping events first. The first thing to say, I suppose, is that I'm Piers Ludlow. I teach at the International History Department here, but I'm also linked to LSE Ideas. The second thing I need to do is to just draw your attention to one or two house rules. The first is that you've all been given feedback forms, or many of you will have been given feedback forms. Please do fill these in and hand them back as you leave, because it's very important to LSE Ideas to find out how our events work and what does function and what doesn't function quite so well. Can I also remind you that the event is being recorded? So be aware of that, and it would also be useful when we get to the Q&A session if people could identify themselves as they ask their question. That would be helpful. And then finally, I need to introduce, well, that's the most important task for a chair to do. I need to introduce tonight's speakers. So we have three excellent speakers for you. And I think the order that we've decided to go in is that the first speaker will be Diego Palmer, who is a special advisor to NATO. He will be speaking first, and he's one of the contributors to the volume, so he'll be speaking particularly about his chapter, but he's also kindly agreed in Linda's absence to give a few overview thoughts to the book as a whole, which I believe he wrote the foreword to, so is in well placed to do so. Then the second speaker will be Stella Adolf or Adolf? I should have checked. Adolf. Okay. Who is a NATO international civilian and currently works in the SHAPE headquarters, I believe. She will be speaking next, and I should stress that both our NATO speakers are speaking in a personal capacity, so what they say will be their own views and shouldn't be taken as committing the whole organisation to anything. And then finally, our third speaker will be my colleague and friend James Ellison, who is a reader in international history at Queen Mary University, so just along the central line from here, and he is also a contributor to the volume, so he will be speaking particularly about that. Each of them have about sort of 10 to 15 minutes or so to share their thoughts and views with you, and then once they've spoken, I'll then open things up for a question and answer session. Oh, the other thing I always forget to announce is that the Twitter hashtag for this event is, I also am very middle-aged and have to take my glasses off to read this, hashtag LSENATO70 without any spaces. Okay, Diego, if I can hand the floor to you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for your kind introduction. I'm very pleased to be here at LSE. It's great to be here in central London on this unexpectedly beautiful afternoon. Pleased to have with me one of my daughters, who is herself a graduate from LSE. So for the family, a sort of return to some of our academic roots. Regrettably, Linda is not with us this evening. I know she was looking very much forward to that. Stella, Linda and I have been part of a sort of Cold War gang at NATO on the 17th anniversary of the alliance over the last several months. And yesterday, the three of us were speaking at NATO headquarters, at the new NATO headquarters in Brussels, to our colleagues about NATO's 70th anniversary, and I think we got pretty good turnout, and it went well. Linda would have been here this evening to speak about her book. I mean, she's the editor of this book that came together from, you know, several conversations that it would be a good idea to try to get several articles from the Cold War History Journal. I think there's some copies in the back. Anyway, this is a well-renowned, well-recognized academic journal on the Cold War. And we spoke about this, and then Linda went ahead and I think a terrific job of going through issue after issue of that journal and tried to select a representative sample of articles that sort of tell the story of NATO, of course, during the Cold War. I mean, that's the focus of the book, is NATO during the first 40 years of the alliance. And I think that's an interesting point to be made, in the sense that for a lot of people, for legitimate reasons, NATO is closely associated with the Cold War. But when you think of it, the Cold War has now been over for 30 years. And, you know, 10 years from now, the post-Cold War history of NATO will equal the Cold War history, be 40 years as well. Which means that I think we can now think of NATO in many other ways than just through the lens of the Cold War, as important as that lens is and continues to be. But there's more to NATO than just the first 40 years. There's a lot that has happened, as we all know, since the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall. Going from 16 member nations in 1989 to soon 30 member nations, where the Republic of North Macedonia will join. Partners around the world, we have 41 partners, including countries like Japan and South Korea and Australia and New Zealand, which have relationships with NATO, and of course our peace enforcement operations in the Balkans in the 1990s, and Afghanistan, and our counter-piracy operations in the Western Indian Ocean, Libya in 2011, and so on and so forth. And I'm sure, you know, that some of you will have some questions or comments about all those things. So I think it is important that we keep that in mind. Linda's intent was to use the opportunity of the 70th anniversary of the alliance to do a sort of historiographical essay, if you will, by picking up a number of articles and saying, look, NATO is more than what you think it is, and it's certainly more than just purely a military organization. And if you read the book, you will see there are many articles, and, you know, just to give you a sense of that, it's very diverse in terms of topics. There's an article about the Third World between 57 and 67 as seen from NATO. There's an article by Linda herself about traveling exhibits. NATO used to send trucks, lorries, around Western Europe in the 1950s and 60s. Of course, there was, you know, barely anything more than facts at the time, but with photos and films. And that was one of the ways to reach out to the people. There are several chapters about the role of the smaller nations. Of course, everybody tends to think about the United States and the UK and Germany and France and Italy as one. But there are several chapters here about countries like Greece and Denmark to show that NATO is not just about the big guys, but also about the role of the important role. You know, I have my own theory that what I call the medium powers of NATO, countries like Canada and Spain, play a very important role as a glue between the larger ones and the large number of smaller countries, because we now have a very large number or very small countries. And the medium powers tend to be a very important part of that relationship between the 5-6 bigger ones and the sort of 15 or so much smaller ones. There is quite a diversity of chapters. There's a chapter also on General Lemnitzer, who was the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe in the 1960s, from the early 60s through the late 60s. So during that time when the U.S. was very consumed in Vietnam, and there's someone in this room who's very knowledgeable about that, it's a time also when France withdrew from the military side of NATO and then returned to NATO in 2009, as you know, under the presence of President Sarkozy. But France had withdrawn in 1966. And that happened when General Lemnitzer was there. So I think it is important to keep all of that in mind in terms of the diversity of NATO, diversity of nations, diversity of histories of different nations. Also, if you're interested in this work, the NATO archives now sits on hundreds of thousands of declassified and disclosed, publicly disclosed pages. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of documents that you can access in many cases online if you just go NATO archives. And so if any of you are interested in any particular aspect of NATO, there is an incredible amount of original material from the civilian headquarters of NATO and from all the various military commands and so on. Now, I wanted to, if I may, just make 3 points on this great book. One, again, on the diversity of NATO. NATO is many things, if you think of it, because it has been around for 70 years. It's quite a long time for an institution. And I'm sure the people who established NATO in 1949 could not conceive of what NATO has become. Again, almost 30 countries, another 40 partners, so that's 70 nations. That's one-third of the membership of the UN. So it's a very, and again, all the way from countries like Colombia to countries like South Korea are associated with NATO. The diversity of things NATO is involved is not just about protection of Europe anymore. It's about peace enforcement operations. It's about security assistance. We're engaged, for instance, in helping countries like Jordan, Iraq, Mauritania. Mauritania has probably Africa's most sophisticated crisis management center in Nouakchott, and that was built by NATO and with the assistance of NATO, and it's now supporting the G5 Sahel nations in terms of fighting extremism in Western Africa. We are involved in a myriad of assistance programs and cooperation programs. Again, we're cooperating very closely with Japan on missile defense, on hybrid warfare, on cyber defense, and so on. And all these nations, you know, from Kazakhstan to Qatar to Tunisia and so on, these 40 nations that cooperate with NATO, they choose what they want to do with NATO. NATO offers, but they choose what they want to do with the alliance. And that now is quite an important aspect of the alliance. The second point I wanted to make is, for me, NATO is first and foremost a political alliance. And I know a lot of people say NATO is a military alliance. It is a military alliance, but it is first and foremost a political alliance. And if you read the North Atlantic Treaty, which I encourage you to do, and it only takes a few minutes to read it because it's a very short document, you will note that the initial articles are really about the political purposes of the alliance. And I always say, you know, almost, in a sort of humorous way, that the most important articles of the treaty are not articles 4, 5, and 6, which is what most people believe. It's really the preamble, then articles 1, 2, and 3. Because the articles 4, 5, and 6, which are about political consultation and mutual defense, coming to one's mutual defense only really exists because Articles 1, 2, and 3 exist. You know, these nations in 1949 decided that they were going to assist one another. And mutual defense is the highest form of that any two nations can have in terms of international relationships. They really have committed by treaty to come to one another's defense. You know, D'Artagnan's famous one for all for one. But that pledge, which they make in Article 5, really exists only because in one Articles 1, 2, and 3, and in the preamble, they say, we stand together. We want to be together. And of course, these original 12 nations, including the United Kingdom, the United States, and many of the other ones, these original 12, they had gone in succession through two world wars that had devastated Europe. And Europe really, in 1945, came very close to the end of European civilization. When you look at the scale of destruction between World War I and World War II, and the amount of people that were killed, Europe was very close to having committed suicide. And the people who sat down in 47, 48, 49 to discuss and say we need to draft something like NATO, it was not so much about mutual defense. It was more, we need a new beginning for the West. We need to draw a line. After 45, it will never be again the same. It's a new beginning. It's a new start. Now, it was not just NATO. It was the Marshall Plan. It was the economic cooperation, the political cooperation, a lot of the other things that came at the time, Council of Europe and all the economic cooperation and so on. But, and of course, what eventually became the European Community and so on. It was all one big scheme. But NATO was a central stepping stone. And I think it is important to remind ourselves that whatever they do militarily or otherwise is really because they want to do it politically. That's what counts. If NATO is politically united, then it will be able to do militarily whatever it wishes to do. But you can have the biggest war machine in the world, if your politics, are not cohesive and don't work well, they're not well aligned, then doesn't mean anything. You could really call it paper tiger. And that's why in NATO, and that's one of the big challenges, I've been a NATO civil servant for several decades. And I'm on my eighth position on the international staff, so I've been really across the headquarters in various positions, is you need to ensure that NATO is politically cohesive and military coherent. And it sounds very easy to say it tonight here, but keeping those two things to align is not so easy. And I can give you several examples where in one situation NATO was politically united, but the military instrument did not work well. Or the other way around, where the instrument was ready to be used, but the allies were not coming together. So that balance between the political and military is very important. One last point. My chapter is the last chapter is, it should be, because really this book is about the diversity, the political diversity. My chapter is on the NATO Warsaw Pact competition in the 1970s and 80s. And for me, it was a competition. And I explain why it was. You know, it was not just NATO is here and the Warsaw Pact is there. These two alliances were looking at each other. They were ostensibly planning to defeat one another if World War III had gone, God forbid. And I think a message there is if you're engaged in the business of deterrence, which is what NATO has been essentially since 1949, deterrence is neither static nor inert. Many people believe it is static and inert. You're just standing guard and being there. But it's not. Deterrence is something you have to work on, because if it becomes unstable, then you could really be in trouble. And you can never assume that your deterrence is going to be permanently assured. And of course, any potential adversary is trying to really get you at that game. And so this chapter about the NATO war supply competition in the 1970s and 80s, and it goes through all the conventional competition and the nuclear and the Pershing 2 and ground cruise missiles and so on. The point there is that it has application that goes well beyond the Cold War. Because, you know, you might be interested in reading just to get a sense of what that competition with the Soviet Union was in the 70s and 80s. But the deeper point is you cannot assume that your deterrence is a permanently established thing. You have to sort of think about it. You have to think about your adversary. What is your adversary's risk calculus? What is your adversary trying to achieve, either by its historical experience or the geographical position or its ideological predisposition? And then how you're going to try to influence a potential adversary, including by engaging. And NATO did engage with the Soviet Union. Actually, there were multiple treaties and meetings and so on. That's not incompatible. I mean, you can deter a potential adversary at the same time engage. But whether you're engaging or deterring or defending, you have to think. That's the essential thing. You have to be a thinking actor of the international system. That's really one of the big, stories, if you will. And I have a monograph coming from the NATO Defense, coming out of the NATO Defense College in Rome, within the next month. That is a history of sort of strategic thinking in NATO as the institution. We'll finish with this. The point there is, at the end of the day, behind the institution, the NATO, the beautiful new NATO headquarters in Brussels, in which I work, or the military commands, where Stella works at SHAPE headquarters, 50 kilometers south from Brussels. All of that, of course, is important. But the most important thing is the thinking power behind the institution, because that's what we're paid for. I mean, this is a real human mission in a way. At the end, you have to be thinking about what are you doing with the mission that has been entrusted to you. And that was an important mission. And again, it was not just about military. You know, if you, again, read the North Atlantic Treaty and read about the history of how this treaty came about in 1948-49. And you get a sense about the idealism of these people who had gone through 60 years of war and peace, mostly war and not so much peace, and who said, never again. Or maybe not 60 years, but only 40 years at a time. And said, never again. And that's why I think NATO is so important, because there is much more to it than the material aspect. Right? And I think at a time where a lot of the things we had assumed to be permanent in the politics of the West are so much in upheaval, it is important to go back to our roots, in a way, and to think, why is it the way it was? Why these things came together in the late 1940s and in a way that was hoped to be almost permanent. There really was a vision, again, of the West, of a community of values, of a community of faith that said, ladies and gentlemen, we got the message. We're not going to go what Europe went between 1910 in 1945. We're not going to go through that again. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Diego. As always, your speech is so good that I have to keep up with that. Well, first of all, good evening to everyone. It's a great honor being here in this building at LSE Ideas, and with you here. Linda, who's unfortunately here with us, asked me to talk about the relevance of NATO history for NATO's planning, strategic thinking, and political debates today. So what she wanted to achieve with that is to further highlight what is already being done in the book, the connection between the political and the military history of the organization. So I like to start with one fact, and that fact is, like in almost no other organization, history matters to NATO. So it matters to its allies, it matters to the partners, it matters to the political and military organization, it matters to the strategic thinkers, and also to the planners. But why is that the case? So the organization has grown organically over 70 years, both militarily and politically. When NATO was formed in 1949, the North Atlantic Treaty and its articles did not yet foresee such an elaborate structure and all the NATO bodies that we have today. NATO underwent a multitude of developments, and I would like to name three here. So the first one is that NATO as an institution underwent a huge institutionalization, in particular of its integrated military structure. And that is without any precedent in history. So we went, for example, from a very regional focus and two regional headquarters, strategic headquarters during the Cold War time, SACLAND in charge of the Atlantic and the sea lines of communication, and Allied Command Europe, to a rather functional structure to meet modern challenges, what we have today, Allied Command Transformation and SHAPE, or Allied Command Operations. The second main development of NATO that I would like to highlight is the evolution throughout the Cold War time of our strategy. So we went from an original strategy of more or less a concept of territorial defense to the first big NATO strategy, the strategy of massive retaliation of the 1950s, that then further developed in the late 60s, and Nigi already mentioned it, to the strategy of flexible response. During that Cold War time, we also had an evolution of our NATO exercises and training. So we went from those rather smaller training and exercises, smaller scale exercises at the beginning, to the huge reinforcement exercises of the 1980s, where we really trained and exercised for conventional defense. And of course, the evolution of our strategic operational planning. So how would NATO assess a threat? How would we define a threat? How would we build, based on that threat assessment, a military strategy to deter and defend? And the third point, or the third main development that NATO underwent, is of course all its transformations. So if you look at NATO and the organization itself, we came from a Cold War conventional and nuclear defensive alliance and went to a modern post-Cold War security organization with an emphasis also on cooperative security, so working with partners, and crisis response and crisis response management. And then in the 21st century, we went to a global, to become a global security forum and a security provider for the Euro-Atlantic with three core tasks and the ability also to project stability and ensure deterrence and defense in a 360-degree approach for over 1 billion people. And those three main developments are highly relevant to today's political decision-making and military planning because of what I call the essence of NATO. And I think there are four factors that make for this very specific, enduring nature of NATO. The first one is that NATO is based on what I call like a special art of communication, or the art of NATO. That has also historically grown. So how the allies and also the partners communicate, how they balance out their interests, how they find consensus, how they're flexible enough to go forward together and not just always go in the one direction of one, but always go in the direction of all 29 or soon 30. The second main factor of the nature of NATO is that the alliance is always and has always been value-based. And these values can be found in the preamble of the treaty, and they endure. They form this pledge of each ally to the others to stand together and to rely on each other, no matter what the situation is, and also to build a true transatlantic community that goes far beyond just being a military alliance. And that is also what Diego highlighted. We are a political alliance. We share these political interests. The third factor is that NATO is and has always been and will always be defensive and cohesive. The cohesion of the alliance has also grown historically across various situations of crisis and of change. And that is closely connected to the fourth factor, and that is that the alliance has adapted over time to various situations to meet different kinds of challenges. And with each of these challenges and with each of those changes, the allies have actually grown stronger together and closer together. So these four factors that make for the essence or the nature of the alliance in their entirety, together with what I said before, like those major developments that NATO underwent, they show that we have a huge, huge number of lessons identified of situations we found ourselves in over 7 decades, lessons learned, all these experiences we had, both with making progress and also the times of crisis and tension. And all these lessons, all these, this entirety of what NATO has experienced, what the Allies have experienced, what others have experienced together with us, they determine how we also take decisions today. They determine where NATO's focus needs to lie. They determine with whom we cooperate. They determine where and when we can act. So especially what I said about the value basis. So this is the core of NATO. So we're not going to depart from that. We're not going to depart from our defensive nature. This is the essence that forms our decisions also today. And these lessons also tell us how we write strategy. They will, for example, we will never depart, as I said, from being defensive, never being departing from being value-based, being a consensus-based group of allies who consider standing stronger together than apart. And all these historical lessons, they help us implement political decisions into military strategic operational planning. So this is what I say is the connection between this political history, what makes also for the political basis of the alliance, and how we implement that daily in the military headquarters. So our history and our lessons, they tell us where are the limits? What are our objectives when we act? What are our aims? What do we want to achieve when NATO actually acts, either with the use of force or just with political or diplomatic measures? How do we ensure our interoperability? That is a very important term for us in the military world. That means, like, how do we have ready and trained forces that are able to act together, and forces that come from 29, soon 30 nations? So what is important right now, and as it has always been, is to have the right forces to deter and to defend, and in general, to act or to be able to act once a political decision was made. So that's an important difference, because some people think that NATO is a military alliance and that the military takes the decisions to what is being done. No, it's a political alliance. So the allies together decide with consensus or based on consensus what they want to do. And based on that political decision, this decision is then being turned into a military action if that is what the allies want. So the Cold War time and also the post-Cold War time are full of examples of different situations of crisis, of progress that was made, and we can learn from them. And what I do on a daily basis, and I would like to highlight that because not everyone knows that we actually really actively work and practically work with our history. So in the historical office at SHAPE, we do take everything what NATO has done, how we decided, how we got to a decision, how we implemented decisions, how we planned before, what were the determining factors of our decisions before. How did we initiate? How did we develop our planning efforts? How did we conduct operations? How did we conduct exercises? How did we develop those? All of this is what we do in our office, and collect these lessons and then translate them for our commanders so that they can take better and more educated decisions based on all the, on the rich history of NATO. It's important to know what were the consequences of our actions before, military actions in particular. What kind of situations did we find ourselves in? What did we have to deal with? And all these lessons, they can be integrated into today's decision-making and planning. So, for example, where is kind of the border or the limit between what was a specific historical situation in the past and what is something that still applies today? Because all of what we, as I, to summarize, because everything what we have observed in those 70 years is useful for today, and it will be useful in the future. Because they, all of these lessons are the part or part of the essence of NATO and what makes for this very special case of NATO. I would like to close with a short comment that Linda and Diego and I have also worked this year in honor of our anniversary on a podcast, a NATO podcast that tells the story of NATO and SHAPE in 12 episodes. It's called An Enduring Alliance, and you can find it anywhere where you can download podcasts, and that gives you a much more thorough overview of NATO history than I was able to give you tonight. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. I should put a plug in for the podcast. I've listened to the Enduring Alliance. It's really, really good. The reason that Diego and Stella are in Brussels and north of Brussels, of course, is because In 1966, the French president evicted NATO from France. Otherwise, the headquarters would have been in Paris. And in the chapter that I write in the book, and I'm very grateful and happy to be in the book because I think it's an excellent collection of different works on NATO, I consider the way that the US and British governments responded to the French president's decision in March 1966 to withdraw France from the integrated military command structures of NATO and to evict NATO personnel, plant, and materials from French soil. Such was the crisis that followed this decision that U.S. congressmen sought to pass a congressional act which disinterred American dead from French cemeteries from the two world wars. It was that bad. The West German Chancellor at the time, Ludwig Erhard, said that this was a moment when the world could go apart. And what he meant by that was that other nations might follow General de Gaulle in challenging the liberal order as it was formed in a military sense through NATO. Now, the great historian of NATO, Lawrence Kaplan, who also has a chapter in the book, as Diego mentioned, has said in his 1988 book on the history of the United States and NATO that this was the most traumatic moment in the institution's history. And of course, we live at a mother moment when we might challenge that idea and say that the current occasion is one when there is a lot of trauma about, because the 70th anniversary of the organization also corresponds with, maybe there's something in this, a lot of press commentary about RIP, the Transatlantic Alliance, mainly because of President Trump's activities and his descriptions of Europeans either in the European Union as foes or because he believes that the Transatlantic Alliance has chronic problems which are epitomized by the fact that the United States pays so much and that European member states and others don't pay enough. Now, we might like to come back to that in the discussion. What I hope to do in my brief remarks is to show you how in 1966, many of the current problems in NATO politically, and I concentrate mostly on the politics of NATO rather than what my colleagues have described in terms of values and the military structures, the politics of NATO were as strained in 1966 as they are nowadays. And back then, we need to understand the significance of the crisis that President de Gaulle created if we want to understand quite how important the resolution of it was, because within a year or more, the NATO alliance had emerged reaffirmed and reinvigorated by the Hamel exercise, which produced a report in 1967 which saw NATO have a new agenda to surpass the challenge and to institute the strength of the institution through the Cold War period. Now, de Gaulle's challenge was indeed that of an imperious French president who believed that America was Europe's daughter, not the other way round, and that NATO in and of itself was an expression of American hegemony in the West, which had to be challenged because no one nation, no matter how great, had a monopoly on ideas about defense in the Cold War, as all nations were involved. But de Gaulle's withdrawal of France from NATO and the eviction of NATO from France was part of a greater challenge that he made to the Western liberal order in the mid-1960s, about which Piers has written, and others too. And what de Gaulle really did was challenge the idea that the liberal order as defined by the United States and its premier allies in 1945, based on the rule of law, institutions, and in essence American dominance, need not be the way that the Western world could evolve. He expressed this in many different forms. Withdrawing France from NATO was one of them, but also identifying France as the leading European power who would be involved in negotiations with the Soviets through the 1960s was another. And that's what caused most distinct concerns in the United States and also the United Kingdom. These two nations working very closely also with the Federal Republic of Germany in meeting the Gaullist challenge. Now, the reason that they were concerned about de Gaulle's actions was simply because he epitomized a wider concern in the Western alliance about the United States and its dominance in the alliance, largely because, of course, of America's war in Vietnam and what this seemed to suggest about American dominance in the conduct of the war. This challenge also came very quickly on the heels of a failure of diplomacy and military negotiation within NATO, which was to create a mixed manned fleet in the NATO organization, the multilateral force, which was essentially designed to deal with the problem of West Germany, which had, of course, since 1955 been committed to non-military cooperation. It could not develop its own nuclear weapons. It could not engage in offensive military organization activities because of the treaties it signed on accession to NATO. But of course, by the mid-1960s, West Germany had grown in stature and was rightly calling for its say in NATO planning and strategy. Because of the politics of allowing West Germans anywhere near the triggers of NATO's military power, a means had to be found of including West Germans in the process of strategic planning activity, short of being involved in the military activities themselves. So the idea of a mixed manned fleet in which the Germans would have a role was the solution to this problem. It failed. It failed at the same time, more or less, as the Gaulle's challenge. And so in the United States of America, the president at the time, Lyndon Baines Johnson, was most concerned that the Germans would start feeling disconnected from the Western alliance, and that they might follow de Gaulle in questioning the very basis of it. As such, he wrote that what he was most concerned about, he wrote this to the British Prime Minister at the time, was a grave danger that the Germans will feel over time that they've been cast adrift, that this could lead to a fragmentation of European-Atlantic relations, which would be tragic for all of us. What he was really pointing to, however, were constant political problems in the transatlantic alliance, and those related to the amount of money that the United States had continually put into the alliance since the late 1940s, and regular calls within the US Congress for increased commitments from Europeans in the defense of their continent. Now, there was a recent harbinger of these rather tense political debates, because in 1953, of course, the Secretary of State in the Eisenhower administration at the time, John Foster Dulles, had made the very same point and threatened an agonizing reappraisal of American commitment to NATO defense unless Europeans started to pay their way. This was very much in the minds of the Americans in the mid-1960s, and they projected that unless the Gaullist challenge was met with a reinvigoration of NATO, then there were distinct problems within the US Congress which might apply pressure to the administration to reduce America's commitment to the transatlantic alliance. Well, in my chapter, I try and describe how the Americans and the British, alongside other allies, principally the West Germans, but also the Belgians, not least in the person of Pierre Armel, the foreign minister, negotiated through cohesion of the alliance in the ways you both described, a reaffirmation of the values and the politics of the preamble, and also thinking about how NATO would evolve out of the Cold War in not only deterrence, but also détente, to surpass de Gaulle's claim that it was an institution dominated principally by the United States of America with no voice for its European member states. So resolution came through reaffirmation and new agendas. And de Gaulle's challenge was beaten for many reasons which we understand are greater than just what was going on in NATO, but nevertheless it was beaten there, as the cohesion of the other member states and their commitment to the interests of defending each other through a military organization which they made political and financial commitments to in order to create a military deterrence succeeded. Now, the question I've been thinking about for our wider discussion today is, what does this era tell us about the eras beyond? Well, the first thing is that there are many distinctions between 1966 and beyond. You could begin with the fact that the transatlantic alliance and NATO survived because it had an existential threat at that time, which has not been as coherent as a threat ever since. That, of course, was communism. It also survived because its dominant partner, the United States of America, remained consistently committed to the structures and to their survival, despite challenges to them, both in the US Congress and amongst European partners. It also survived in the mid-1960s because de Gaulle was pretty much alone as a head of government or state who seriously questioned the foundations of the order which NATO represented militarily. So it was quite straightforward for the other allies to cohere around a reinvigorated NATO agenda. That's not necessarily always been the case since. And there hadn't been years of disgruntlement in which the US Congress had been telling successive administrations that the Americans are paying too much for the defense of the West as a whole and that Europeans ought to pay more for their own defense. So those are the differences. There are enduring features, however, which help us understand why NATO has cohered and sustained, I think. Those were revealed mostly after 1989 with the end of the Cold War, when there were questions about how NATO would survive, what its purpose would be in a post-communist world. And it's true to say that the harbingers were not good, because in the early 1990s it was felt that amid the tragic wars in the former Republic of Yugoslavia, NATO had not seen its new purpose. The Americans were concerned that the Europeans did not cohere to intervene in what was described by the American diplomat most engaged in them, Richard Holbrooke, as the most tragic incidents since the interwar period and the Holocaust. The Europeans were concerned that the Americans weren't fulfilling their own role in defending the West as a whole and coming to terms with what was going on in the former Republic of Yugoslavia, which was an outcome of the Cold War, by their definition, which the Americans had responsibility to clear up. The second point, which shows that the alliance had to endure beyond the end of the Cold War and find a new purpose, is that after 9/11 particularly, and in the lead up to the Iraq War of 2003, the idea that there was something fundamentally at stake which needed to be resolved, i.e. the purpose of the alliance, was quite clear in the differences that existed between the United States and its allies, principally the United Kingdom, but not only the United Kingdom, and then what certain American figures described as old Europe, principally France and Germany. There was this idea at that time that there was something philosophically wrong in the alliance, that it had not been solved as a problem since the end of the Cold War, and that at any moment a traumatic crisis like 1966 could come up, and maybe 2003 was that. And what was philosophically wrong was characterized by a former American State Department official called Robert Kagan. You've probably come across his book, Paradise and Power, in which he claimed in rather blunt fashion that what the Iraq War of 2003 had shown was that since the end of the Cold War, Europe and the United States had followed very different trajectories. Kagan argued that Europe had turned away from power and made itself weak behind the defense shield of NATO, which had been paid for by American administrations. And he said that in the same period, whilst the Americans were in fact presenting European allies with this defense shield, the Americans had become mired in history, a strong power willing to fight for a liberal order, seeing military problems as military problems rather as issues to be negotiated around. One of the quotes, of course, which sold the book was Kagan's declaration that it's time to stop pretending that Europeans and Americans share a common view of the world, or even that they occupy the same world. Now, most informed commentators at the time thought Kagan's characterizations were too binary. Not all Americans were militaristic adventurers. Not all Europeans were pacifists. The alliance had survived many crises. It survived in the mid-60s. It had survived the end of the Cold War. It had survived the problems of Yugoslavia. But would it survive the shock that came as a result of the Iraq War, largely because that did fundamentally ask questions about liberal order, law, international institutions, and the differences between a Western hegemon and lesser, in terms of material power, European allies. Well, that gets us to where we are today, more or less, with these questions still in the air, and not least because of President Trump's recent statements. Although President Trump's statements about problems in the alliance were only harsher and more brutal statements that have been made through the Bush and Obama administrations about balance of power and commitment in terms of finance and expenditure. But for all of Trump's statements and for all of Europe's lack of cohesion in response so far, don't think it's necessarily, if we think about the 1960s, any cause for real concern about the future of the alliance, as Diego and Stella have suggested, because there are two major factors at stake, and they've been revealed most recently in the cohesion that we've seen in response to Putin's Russia and the provocative actions, both military and political, that have been in all of our minds over the last 18 months. And the fact is that Americans outside of the current administration, you only need to look at the Belfer Center at Harvard, which has a study project on NATO. They published a report in February of this year, which identified 10 challenges and 10 answers. And their main argument was that the administration had to look beyond its current stance on NATO to think of the necessity of maintaining it in a yet more unstable realpolitik world, where the structures of liberal order are no longer guaranteed, and the way that Diego's just described, permanence is in fact something which has to be worked at. It's not a given. There's that factor. The Americans themselves are reconsidering the Trump administration's policy. And then there's also the factor that one of the early European fathers of the community, Robert Marjolin's view, which was that the Europeans had spent too much money on butter and not enough on guns, remains true. The European Union has yet to cohere around a common foreign security policy and to produce a military capability which matches that of NATO. And as long as that's the case, and it may change, but at the moment it doesn't seem to be so, the Europeans will remain committed to NATO and seeking, through the quiet diplomacy that we saw in the 1960s, to cohere around a reaffirmed or perhaps new agenda, as they did in the 60s and 70s, 80s, but also in the 2000s, to produce cohesion with the United States and a further administration. I think I'll leave it there, please. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well, we've had three very wide-ranging views of NATO and its history and the role of history within its thoughts and planning. I suggest that, as you've heard rather a lot from this table, why we straight away throw the floor open to some questions. Is there a roving microphone? Yes. So if you, once I've identified sort of who the lucky speaker is, could you identify yourself and wait for the microphone? So thank you. Yes.
This is Michael Farr. Thank you so much for such an enriching talk. I do have a question regarding to Kosovo, and maybe I can hear some reflections, since there's an evolving kind of a nature for NATO from when it started to what it became today. Can we hear more about the Kosovo situation, lessons learned more than anything, in terms of that kind of evolution? I mean, there was a whole debate of legitimacy versus legality and whatnot. So what were the lessons learned from that, and how much of a impact they had on where or what the NATO is today? Thank you.
Who wants to take that one on?
Sure. Well, you're right to say Kosovo is a moment of great tumult, isn't it? It could have been another crisis. In fact, the heads of state were concerned about that, and the April 1999 summit in Washington, which was another anniversary, was very fragile, because at heart you had a United States administration led by a reluctant interventionist president who didn't wish to commit U.S. troops to a ground war in Kosovo, yet most strategists in NATO itself seemed to be of the view that an air war alone would not solve the problem. You had a very interventionist U.K. prime minister who was seeking to put pressure on the United States government in public to get commitment to liberal order and intervention through ground troops, and you had an uncertain alliance about quite what should be done between a position that was American-led, they were calling for that, and one which was going to be European-led, but there didn't seem to be a European-led one. And then you have the other issue which you raised, which is really significant in this whole story, I think, which is that Kosovo was the first occasion when a NATO-led force doesn't have UN authorization to use force and cross borders in a sovereign land. What it seems, from my perspective, at least in terms of the politics of it, to represent is the old-fashioned diplomacy still works, in that what I've seen so far of those records is that heads of state talk to each other to ensure that the 50th anniversary worked rather than fall apart, and that a new cohesive agenda was achieved once again. Everybody then looked away from the fact that the Americans and the British were going to take action without getting UN authority as well. So I don't think it solved that essential problem, and it was almost benched for a later era, and we still see it questioned now. But what the lessons learned for NATO as an alliance were was that they had to hold together or fall apart, just as Europe faced perhaps its greatest internal threat since the origins of the Cold War.
If I may, just to add a few additional perspectives, I think if one goes back, you know, if you re-roll that film back to the mid-1990s. First, I think the West in general was not well prepared psychologically for the wars in the former Yugoslavia. In a way, things in Europe had gone well after the fall of the Berlin Wall. There had been no bloodshed as the Warsaw Pact was disappearing, as Germany went ahead with unification. And suddenly things went badly in the former Yugoslavia. And that came a little bit as a surprise and as a shock. The United States, if you will, had felt that in terms of the East-West confrontation, mission had been accomplished and was withdrawing major parts of its military from Western Europe at that part. The United States had gone through that bottom-up review when General Powell was the Chairman Joint Chiefs of Staff. So, you know, the influence at the time was, let's focus really on Eastern Europe, about bringing the democracies of Eastern Europe towards NATO and the European Union, and Yugoslavia came up really as a surprise, although, you know, the international community actually acted, particularly France and the UK, became the main two military actors by putting troops on the ground under the UN flag and so on. The second point is, by the time you get to 1999, when Milosevic, they had been there before with Milosevic over Bosnia and Herzegovina. And that had been painful enough. And we all remember the chaos that was Bosnia and Herzegovina in the early 1990s and all the loss of life. And the West was seeing basically sort of a new rerun of that in Kosovo. And this time the patience of the leaders in the West vis-a-vis Milosevic was really running thin, particularly because there had been a diplomatic process at Rambouillet, south of Paris, about trying to find a way out. And basically the view of the Western nations vis-a-vis intervention in Kosovo is there had been resolutions by the UN Security Council about having a monitoring mission in Kosovo under the OSCE, disarmament, negotiations in Rambouillet, and that was leading nowhere. So they felt basically the contract is not being respected by Milosevic. And that was the trigger for action. In terms of the internal dynamics in NATO, I think that's one example where I think the Allies were actually quite united. You know, when they launched that operation, remember, a few months before the launch of that operation in March 1999, three new nations had joined the alliance. The first members from Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. So we're now 19 members. But they were very united, and NATO deployed over 1,000 aircraft into this operation. But militarily, it didn't deliver well. And there was a lot of frustration at the political level that this air operation in Kosovo was going too slow in relation to the political will. And I think this is a good example, Kosovo air operation, where there was a gap between the political unity and coherence of NATO and the ability of NATO to deliver effects. Now, there are all kinds of reasons. You can go into the Kosovo operation, why, you know, there was bad weather, a lot was about close air support inside Kosovo against the Serbian army and against the Serbian paramilitary. This was March, April, very bad weather in Kosovo. You had to fly low, you have to fly slow because you're trying to get Serbian forces that are in the woods, in the mountains. It's a very broken terrain. And then there was a discussion whether you should then go for a larger campaign that was targeting Serbia itself and Belgrade. And that happened. But there was a whole discussion. And then you get into, you know, theoretical debates about compellence versus deterrence, you know, how much you're trying to deter Milosevic from going further, how much you're trying to compel. Should he be compelled by targeting the Serbian army inside Kosovo, or should you go to a strategic bombing campaign against Serbia itself? And there was, you know, back and forth. So Kosovo is really an interesting episode in terms of that. But you really, to understand what happened in 1999, NATO in Kosovo, you really have to go to the start of what happened in the former Yugoslavia, around 89, 90, with Milosevic abandoning, in a way, communism and turning to Serbian nationalism as his main mantra. And then what he did at the famous battlefield where he went and, you know, energized the Serbian people and so on, and to understand that, you know, and of course a lot of books have been written, but I'm not sure that the definite story about that is out, and probably will take a little bit more time to get all the archives.
Yeah, I would like to make maybe two general remarks. The first one is that I'd like to highlight the great achievements that we've seen in that region, in the Western Balkans overall. in particular, not just the achievement of having an end to all the conflicts, like there is no civil war, there is no genocide for many, many years now, but also many of the countries of that region have successfully and voluntarily integrated into Europe, some of them into the European Union, some of them have become NATO members. And they have also undergone a huge and amazing internal stabilization and development over the last years. I think this is something that needs to be highlighted. And then about the other factor about NATO and the relationship to the United Nations, or like how NATO acts within the United Nations framework. Well, also for that, it's probably good to go back in history and remember how and why NATO was founded in 1949. So one of the reasons it was founded was that whilst the United Nations had been already founded or created a short time before, because of the constellations in the Security Council at that time, with the Soviet Union also and China present, it was clear to the European countries and North America at that time that they wanted to have a forum where they would be able to consult and to react to crisis and conflict once they agree amongst each other. So whilst it is already written down in the North Atlantic Treaty that NATO acts within the United Nations framework, of course, the nations, the allies always wanted to have this ability to consult, like in Article 4, and also to act in Article 5 when they consider a serious threat to the overall security of the region. So I think the lesson learned from also the Kosovo episode, as well as like also with the other situations in the Balkans of that time, is that it was important for the allies to stand together and to be able to act together, especially when it comes to bloody conflicts, civil wars in particular, and of course also genocide. And one story that's always a little bit forgotten is the one about Macedonia, North Macedonia, because that is one conflict that actually did not go as crazy as the other ones, and not go as violent as the other ones, because there was this early interaction. That was one of the lessons also from Kosovo. There was the early diplomatic interaction, and also the disarmament of the armed groups in order to avoid further conflict. And I think all these stories, as also Diego has highlighted, all these different stages in the Balkan Wars have to be seen in their entirety, and also in the connection of what NATO and allies want to achieve once they act and once they decide to act.
Thank you. Okay, so a further question here in the front row.
Thank you. I'm Michael Blaschke, a visiting researcher. I have two questions that go into the challenges. One is, what makes NATO relevant today, particularly for the naive non-historian or... yeah. And second, is NATO ready for cyber war?
Okay. Again, who wants to take that?
Okay. So the first one about the relevance of NATO. Well, that's a story that I could talk about like probably for hours. But I think the main one is one point that I also mentioned in the lecture, and that is that NATO is not just an alliance. It is the most successful alliance in history so far, in probably modern history and in overall human history, because it brings a group of allies together, but not just for an opportunist or selective reason or for a short-term reason. It's really a group of nations that are interested in cooperating over a huge amount of time, and they have done so successfully so far. And nowadays, NATO is also a global security forum. Like, it brings nations together, and not just those 29 and soon 30, but it also interests more and more nations to join, because that's like a way to communicate on a daily basis. So what we see, for example, where I work at Shape, is that whilst there's always political debates and always controversies, how we act, how we might react, how we want to act, there is this daily exchange of how we can get our troops ready to fight together whenever there's something happening that might lead to a crisis or a conflict. We have this daily exchange of nations, you know, working in an office with 5, 6, 7 or more nationalities and communicating every day and overcoming those cultural, sometimes differences or different approaches, and learning from each other. I think this makes for the relevance of NATO. And I know that's not always visible to the public. It's also part of this experience that we have we enjoy on a daily basis. But I think this is what really made the allies stand together for such a long time. This is something that doesn't get mentioned a lot. And for the cyber war, you've probably followed that in the media, that we've undergone a huge command structure adaptation, where the aspect of cyber war, especially in a defensive mode, because again, NATO is a defensive organization, so it's all about defense. We have started creating structures and commands also that deal with this type of warfare, because it is part of the modern warfare.
Do either of you want to say anything
on that? On the cyber aspect, I think you, in a way, you pose a wider question, which is the issue of future war. You know, many times nations are accused of preparing for the last war. And this is a recurrent theme about what is future war, how would a future war break out, how would it be fought, how would it be won, what would be a definition of victory. And all that is quite difficult to define ahead of time. Secondly, what is cyber war? Is cyber war something that happens every day? Because every day there are cyber disruptions around the world. Some are known. Some are kept secret. You will never know. And therefore, what are thresholds of pain that independent sovereign nations will be willing to accept? What is the business community view of cyber war? What is the level of economic pain that the banking system or the transportation system is prepared to accept? And that plays, of course, into the view that nations have about what you would call cyber war. Is cyber war about protecting your communications and information systems, whether they are private sector, public sector, whether they are military or not? Or is cyber war the expectation by doing something in the cyberspace, you will win, whatever that winning means? But it will be such a stroke. You know, there were a couple of American specialists in the 1990s that spoke of a cyber Pearl Harbor, that, you know, an overwhelming cyber attack that would dislocate your command and control and your communications on a, such a scale that you would be defeated within a few hours. Again, cyber is also evolving in such a way that it is difficult to tell whether that is realistic or not. So it's a very difficult question to answer whether NATO is. NATO, basically, there are really three tiers of NATO's involvement. At the center, NATO is responsible for protecting its own NATO-owned and operated networks. So we have a number of communications and information systems networks that have been procured collectively by the nations by pooling their funding, and those are operated by NATO itself, and those are protected, or we're at least working very hard to protect them. The second tier is what NATO can do in support of the member nations at their request. So if a NATO member nation turns to NATO headquarters and says, we need your advice, we need your assistance, then NATO provides to one of our member nations, that is it. The third is what the nations themselves are doing, the member nations, in terms of their cyber resilience. And there are NATO committees where you have the member nations come together and discuss, exchange ideas, exchange information about what it is. But cyber, by its very nature, because it's immaterial in a way, and it is evolving very quickly in many ways. And if you don't have all the technical expertise and knowledge, you can be distanced very quickly. So it's a very difficult question. And, you know, if you look at warfare and human history, whether a nation won or lost was what happened on that day. They couldn't have forecast they were necessarily going to win or lose. They didn't know. And it just happened as things developed during in the battlefield and the situation. So I'm not sure that we will ever be able to say with full confidence that NATO is well protected and well prepared, but we're certainly working very hard on it.
Okay. Perhaps if I take two questions now. I've seen this gentleman here, but perhaps as you're close to him, Malcolm, can I hand over to you. Yeah,
thanks very much, Piers. Thank you very much, all three of you. I want to pose a challenge to you. It's very great to be congratulatory about NATO. What about Georgia and the Crimea and Mr. Putin?
Okay, short and sharp. And if we can collect the question at the front too.
My question is somewhat related to that question in that I heard very little about enlargement and the experience of enlargement, and I wondered on the one hand, what some of those lessons were, especially with an emphasis on mistakes made, or what could have been done better, and also whether there is a dichotomy between simply a view in any quarters of the organization that some states are better left as defense partners but not members of the alliance. Thank you.
Okay, so who wants to come in on either of those?
Who wants to go? No, go ahead.
Georgia and Crimea, I would put in the frame of the indecision amongst the alliance about when to intervene, principally the politics of the alliance. I don't think amongst the military figures there's any, well, there's, in my experience of what I studied in the 60s and the 90s, little indecision amongst military figures. They know what needs to be done and how they'd like to do it. It's the politics of it. And I think one of the lessons of Kosovo is that a solution came because Milosevic was not only concerned about the power of the United States of America and NATO cohesion, but also Yeltsin's Russia. And the idea that Yeltsin would withdraw support for Milosevic weakened his position in his own mind, and hence he came to a solution in part. Yeltsin was much more pliant than Putin. I think what Georgia and Crimea seem to represent, but my colleagues are more expert than me, is unanswered questions about the political will of member states to commit troops on the ground, especially in a post-Iraq war era.
I think it is clear that NATO has a policy of an open door to continue to enlarge. That's in the treaty. That sovereign democratic nations in Europe that wish to join the alliance will be given the opportunity to join if conditions are right. And as you know, there is that perspective for Ukraine and Georgia that was set out in 2008. The evolution of Russia since 2000, it's something that, you know, you can write books about it. There are a range of perspectives on that. No doubt that Russia has carved a policy of entrenching conflicts on its periphery as a means to complicate the Western path from a number of nations. I mean, you could see it in the Republic of Moldova already in 1991 with Transnistria. And if you go back to the detail of what happened in Transnistria in 1991, as a sort of secessionist territory that was dominated by Russia, you would see a lot of the same that you would then find in Crimea, you know, in 2014. So this is a pattern that has been established by Russia as a means to assert its influence. But there is enduring a close partnership between NATO and Georgia, and NATO and Ukraine, and NATO and the Republic of Moldova. They are all three partners of NATO. NATO has programs of cooperation with those nations. There was recently a major NATO exercise in Georgia, but we regret the Russian policy of sort of territorial encroachment as a means to assert an illegitimate presence there. But NATO, I think, is very united that, as the treaty sets out, any European nation that fulfills the purposes of the treaty in regard also to the principles of liberty, democracy, the rule of law, is entitled to request, if that's what they want, is entitled to request membership. And as you know, NATO has expanded from 16 to now 29, nearly 30 nations. But of course, it is true that given who Russia is and where Russia is located, and it is a complicated process, no doubt, and there's no doubt that Russia makes it complicated. But again, we could have, you know, we could spend the evening discussing what the trajectory of Russia has been under President Putin since 2000. I would just conclude by saying NATO has had a strong partnership relationship with Russia, as you know. There was a first agreement in 1997, the agreement of the Elysee Palace. Then there was another agreement in 2002 with Russia that was signed close to Rome, Pratica di Mare. We established a NATO-Russia Council. We had close military-to-military cooperation. I myself run a NATO-Russia crisis management exercise between 2002-2004, working very closely with the Russian General Staff in Moscow. So there's no doubt that there has been a strong commitment by the alliance to work with Russia, because this has been an enduring policy of NATO, as James reminded us since the Harmel report, of this dual-track policy of, you know, sticking to our purposes and our missions and our tasks as set out in the treaty, but always find ways to have a dialogue and cooperate, which we did during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and we did with Russia after the end of the Cold War. But the facts speak for themselves that today it is not an easy undertaking.
Stan?
Yeah, I would like to close because I think we have had already a very good explanations and answers to these questions. But I would like to close with two myths about NATO. So I don't know if you know the old TV show Mythbusters. I really like to watch that and like to kind of learn about myths and how they can be solved. So the first one is that NATO enlargement is something that NATO is pursuing and the nations are kind of forced into it. That's one myth, I think, that exists, which is not true, because all the nations, they have to request by themselves that they want to become a NATO. They undergo a very long process, political process, negotiations, and so on. So you cannot do that if you're forced. Like, this is something that nations choose to do. And the first round of growing of NATO, you could see right after the end of the Cold War, when a lot of the countries that were formerly in the Warsaw Pact, and they were not there voluntarily, choose to become part of NATO because of this appeal of our values, of our value-based alliance, of this group of interested nations to work together. So that's one important fact. And any further enlargement, and I'm particularly not a fan of this term, because I think it maybe leads into this myth direction too much, is really that nations choose to do that. And nations will continue to choose to become either a partner of NATO or a member or somehow interested because they want to, because they have a domestic internal process, that they want to associate with NATO. And the other myth is about that NATO nations or NATO can only act or only acts by the use of force. That is not true. And if you read the North Atlantic Treaty, you see that all our articles go also in other directions, in economic cooperation, and for sure also in consulting. So once a crisis appears, what we have seen in Crimea, what we have seen in Georgia, that doesn't mean that NATO nations have to use force to intervene anywhere. They normally choose to consult about a crisis, and then they choose whatever measure they deem necessary that has or follows the aim of having an influence on the situation. It doesn't mean that it needs to be groups or troops on the ground or any kind of military action. In these two cases, they did not choose to do that, just because the aims, the objectives could be achieved in a different way.
Probably time for one final question. Does somebody? Yes, Dora at the front. It's always the furthest walk away for...
Hello, my name is Dora from LSE Ideas. Thank you very much for all your valuable contributions. And I think you all talked about how NATO is a political project and political cohesion is at the very heart of the organization. And I think today we see lots of sources of incoherence. For example, the Trump administration or Hungary becoming friends with Russia. Do you think that these problems can be overcome and the damage done by these negative forces can be repaired ever?
Nice, easy question to end with.
That one definitely needs some reflection, doesn't it? My NATO colleagues will have answers from a historical perspective. I think, yes, the answer is yes, because in terms of the answer to the gentleman at the front's question about NATO's relevance today, if you believe in the liberal international order, even though that is a simplistic concept historically, it's always been much more complex than that. But if you think to yourself about the way the world could have gone with different alternatives in the interwar period, then the fact that there's been, according to critics of the United States of America, a neo-imperialist hegemon which has expressed its power through a military organization, that's a critical view. There's another view, which is that it has put a shield around its member states from 14 through to 29, and that it's produced a period of peace and security which has not been known on the continent of Europe. You can think about the millions of dead up till 1945 and then the relative amount that haven't been killed since. Then it's a good thing. And what it does is remind its member states constantly, not least through the North Atlantic Treaty, but also the current reviews ever since then, of the principles at stake. And if you think that institutions act as coherent bodies which create frameworks for cooperation, and through the cooperation you create an institutional body or idea, this is what historians are saying about the League of Nations right now, then NATO does that. And what it does is reaffirm the need to ensure that extremes don't foster greater movements than they are. So I remain hopeful that NATO can help them.
Yeah, I would just add, you know, as many of you, I'm sure, know well, there's a whole field of studying political science and sociology about institutions. But institutions are truly living bodies. NATO, you see that contest, some I would put it that way, contest of ideas among member nations. These are nations that have been around for a long time. They are, you know, many of them have been around for several centuries. They know a lot about politics, about international relations. At the end of the day, they are sovereign nations. They are freely associated in NATO as an expression of free will. And nobody can tell any nation how to behave. It's a free association. I think they're all mindful of the considerable damage that could be done to everything that is embodied in NATO. It has been embodied for 70 years. If that tissue of mutual trust that has been built, you know, through successive generations is damaged. You know, the, people ask about this rule of consensus. By the way, the consensus rule is not written anywhere in the treaty. It's a practice. But that's how NATO has been deciding all the way back since 1949. Now, if you take the nations, they have to go through building consensus every day on very important issues like how to deal with Russia, how to engage in arms control, what new measures to take in terms of deterrence and defense, all the way to minutiae issues of budgets and so on. But every day, in tens and tens of different committees, nations come to consensus. They do so freely, and they do so because they know that they can refuse to join consensus if they want to. And there are multiple examples in the history of NATO where consensus was not found. Now, the nations around the table, they know that the intent of the whole enterprise is to reach consensus. I mean, ostensibly, that's the reason to sign the treaty. And so the impulse inside the organization is to find consensus, as hard as it might be. And sometimes it takes... nights, and talking about not Kosovo, but Bosnia-Herzegovina, when Secretary General Manfred Werner of Germany was the Secretary General. And he was dying of cancer in that office. He fought very hard for the consensus. He personally, as he was a dying man, still exercising his office. And I was there when all that happened. He took the consensus rule very seriously. And he told the nations, it is your consensus rule and you better deliver on this. And he was very instrumental in 1993, 1994, 1995 in making sure that the Allies will stick together in confronting Milosevic in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But they join the consensus because they know they can refuse. Although they realize at the end of the day that if consensus is not reached, is a defeat for all. You know, in NATO there isn't really winners and losers. Either they're all together winners because they've reached consensus, or they're all losers if they don't. And at the end of the day, it's their responsibility. It is their alliance. They signed the treaty. They established this institution. If it works, great. If it doesn't, what can I say?
Stella?
Yeah, one closing remark about that. Well, the interesting thing about history is when we look back, things always look easy, right? They look like this is the way it would have gone and should have gone, and this is the only way. But that's not true. And we also have always this feeling like now things are particularly difficult, but they weren't in the past. But that is, I think, a trick of the human mind and of our memory. Because actually, the nations and NATO in particular, since 1949, they have undergone a lot of crises. There have been multiple crises in every single decade, in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and so on. And none of these political and security environments were easy to deal with. And the nations struggled sometimes. They struggled to find consensus. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. But they kept on striving. They kept on trying to find consensus. And in most cases, they did. And I think that's the interesting part. So I think that even now, if this environment seems even more challenging, it's probably not more challenging than before. But that struggle to actually find consensus, to cooperate on a daily basis, whilst it's not always easy, in most cases, it's like, it's hard work, right? It's hard work to talk to each other. You can start with your family. If you think about how often you have discussions, how often you need to, you know, to find agreement and you need to discuss things, sometimes up to a point that you really don't want to talk about it anymore. And it's kind of the similar thing on the international stage. So nations with different interests, like individuals with different interests, they need to talk about it to find a solution, a way forward. And sometimes maybe there is no real straight way forward. Maybe it's like a little bit of wiggling around. Maybe it's like thinking about it for a few more days or months. But that's just the nature of international relations. And I don't think that particularly now we're in necessarily more difficult times that are of a greater danger to the cohesion than all the dangers we had before. But the alliance has proven quite resilient in overcoming such crises.
It's probably good to end on that optimistic note before we get beset by too much gloom. I think we should thank all three panelists for a wide-ranging and fascinating set of insights. So I would ask you to join in me.